make a comment or two about the medial lateral mode thing. We moved right by it, but hey, couldn't we have taken a day on those two columns, especially the right-hand column? Because that really is the shadow, if you will. It's the underrepresented in our culture and in most people's lives. Certainly true for me. And then I think there is in the heart of many of us a kind of longing for the right-hand column. In many ways, when people are really relaxed, really unthreatened, not in pain, not agitated, not struggling, not greedy and grasping, etc., not biochemically disturbed, they tend to default to the right-hand column as a kind of natural resting state. And I think that's why being, you know, precedes doing. Being is more fundamental than doing. So, a little detail, a line from Soknyi Rinpoche, a great Tibetan teacher, with regard to one of the maybe not so obvious methods I deployed there for lighting up those lateral networks. Here we go. He made a comment. He said, people think there's a problem with thinking or with thoughts. Thoughts are not the problem. The problem is that we glue them together. See? And if you think about it, when we're in that midline, that medial mode, we tend to glue our thoughts together and it has that feeling to it. It's a very dense stream of thoughts. Whereas if we're more in lateral mode activation, it's kind of quieter, more spacious. There's some room between the thoughts. It's like if John Cage said, you know, music is the silence between the notes. There's more silence, if you will, between the notes when we're in that lateral mode of activation. We're not so gluing them together. And I think in part that corresponds to the fact that if you were to look at a map of neural networks in the midline, it looks a lot like the Boston, New York hub from space. Very dense networks of highways and streetlights and traffic patterns and so forth. Whereas when you look at neural networks on the right-hand side, it looks more like country roads, you know, from a space station. A lot more spaciousness. And I think that corresponds to the subjective experience of thoughts not being so glued together. So it's been helpful for me, actually, in business settings and other settings when things are getting a little tense, to deliberately and privately activate that lateral mode at will. You know, feeling the body, like with a couple long exhalations, that gives you that nice parasympathetic nervous system activation, because the parasympathetic nervous system handles exhalation. All right. Also, for example, just feeling the body as a whole, that takes you right out into the right hemisphere, where most of those lateral networks are situated, because it handles gestalt processing. If you're aware of the whole, that's very much the right hemisphere. It's not sequential. It's gestalt. All right. Another one is to just kind of not know. I can find my eyes unfocusing when I go into not know mode. Not knowing mode is different from stupid mode. Right? One can be very aware and awake and not know what anything is. Right? What anything really is. Okay. So moving along. All right. Now, I'm pretty excited about this stuff, the enlightened brain. And by that, I want to talk about, you know, what could plausibly be the nature of the brain of an arahant, which is the technical term in Buddhism, for the fourth and last stage of enlightenment, which is to say, someone for whom literally no longer greed, hatred, and delusion no longer arise. Or if they do arise, even, you know, microsecondly, they self-liberate in the moment of their arising. Okay. Well, if you think about the brain and how it evolved, etc., it's quite radical to imagine, particularly if you take it as true that such beings have actually existed, and I do, because I think the evidence is there that they have existed and may well live in this world today. What in the world is going on in a brain in which no longer is there any kind of greed, hatred, or delusion? Delusion, broadly defined, is a kind of ignorance, fundamentally, of the two marks of existence, or, which is to say, ignorance of the fact that everything changes and ignorance of the fact that everything's connected to everything else. All right. Oh, yeah. Ignorance of two things. First, that everything changes, and ignorance of the fact that everything is connected to everything else, which includes the realization, which deepens, that there really can't be an I, a me. There could be eyeballs, but no I, you know, which is a deep teaching. We do a whole workshop on that in December, I think, but we're not going to go more to that today. But the larger point is that if you start at the end, if you want to get good at anything, study the people that are good at it. Want to get good at cooking, watch those cooking shows. My family's a little addicted to it, to those. Oh my God, bacon ice cream. Are you kidding? You know, stuff like that. similarly, if you want to get good at happiness, love, and wisdom, study the people that have made that their life's work, including people who have really fulfilled the journey. Okay, so what in the world could be going on in their brain? And then how can we promote those factors inside our own heads? That's what I want to get at this afternoon. So, in other words, what's the nature of the brain when a person is in these states? Peak productivity, self-actualization, or moving more into the deep end of the pool, enlightened or close to it. Now, to do that, we have to think about evolution, because that's what gave us the brain we have today. So check out this slide. It's kind of remarkable to just take a big breath and in the Grateful Dead lyric, just look what a long, strange trip it's been. You know? The Earth's been around about 4+ billion years. Fairly quickly, life arose for whatever reason it arose, or whatever reasons, plural. 3.5 billion years, about 650 million years of multicelled organisms. When I get a cold, I sometimes think, you know, those germs had a 3 billion year head start. Darn it. That explains a lot, you know, if you think about it. And they breed really fast, too. Their turnover rate is really, really quick. Nervous system came along about 600 million years ago when those multicelled organisms got complicated enough that they needed to connect their sensing organs and their motor systems so they could send signals inside, right? What's mind? Mind is signals. Mind is information moving through this material substrate. Immaterial information enabled by a material substrate, which it continues to change. Okay? And then bringing it forward, 80 million years or so of mammals, depending on how you define that altogether, 60 or so million years of primates. 6 million years ago, last common ancestor with the chimpanzees. We are among the great apes. By the way, to put this in broader perspective, how many of you have seen a banana? All right, bananas. We share about 20% of our DNA with bananas. Puts it in perspective, doesn't it? All right? We share a lot of DNA with the great apes. We are among the great apes. It's chimpanzees, bonobos, orangutans, gorillas, and us. Woo, woo, woo. You know, it's our buddies. It's our cousins, right? That's us. And then bringing it even more forward, stone toolmakers, about 2.5 million years ago with a brain a third our size. 150,000 years roughly of Homo sapiens, literally just in the last about month or two. Scientists have sequenced Neanderthal DNA and discovered that Neanderthals that lived with humans actually interbred with human beings. They had sex together.
That explains it.
That explains a lot of things, as my friend Daniel says. Although, Neanderthals had bigger brains than ours a little bit and didn't seem so bad after all. In any case, there has been some gene transfer from the Neanderthal line to the human line. How many of you, by the way, have blue eyes? This is one of my favorites. Blue or green? Keep your hands up. Don't be afraid. You are all mutants. There were no blue eyes until about 5,000 years ago. Some little person in probably around Denmark somewhere had blue eyes, boy or girl, and must have been really hot because, you know, those genes have spread today, all right, in just a few thousand years. All right, so evolution is ongoing. Evolution is ongoing. Okay? So it's in that context, then, that these three motivational systems arose. And this, for me, is a really useful framework for understanding this question of, okay, what's the nature of an enlightened brain or something kind of that's pretty far along in the path, and then how do we reverse engineer and promote the causes and conditions of that brain, which then leads to that kind of mind. So, three systems. The first system was avoid, pull back, freeze, all right, withdraw. Tickle a sea anemone, what does it do? You know, pulls back. That's a very effective system and a very basic one. Okay? Next system that kind of got laid on top of that is the approach system. In more nuanced and complex ways, fish, crabs, iguanas, what have you, go out and get stuff. All right, go get those carrots. And then we have the third system, which came in with the birds and the mammals, the attach system. It's probably true that some, it is true that some fish and some lizards have some kind of quality of involvement with their young, and probably there were some dinosaurs that did as well, but in many ways those are the exceptions that prove the rule. You know, in proportion to body weight, birds and mammals have bigger brains than fish and reptiles do. What's the thing that birds and mammals do that fish and reptiles don't? They pair bond and raise young. All right? You got to be smarter to raise those kids. I don't know how many of you are parents. My wife and I realized that after our first child came along, holy moly, we had so much more we had to think about and so many more hassles to work through. You know, who watches the kids? Who goes and gets the nuts? You know, why didn't you bring the nuts home? You brought the wrong kind of nut home. Like, well, who are you to tell me about the wrong nut, you know? I like this kind of nut, or whatever. So much to think about. They have bigger brains, right? And then came primates. We're like so complicated, gossipy, you know, who scratches whose back, you know, the complexity of the hierarchy. There's literally a correlation between this complexity of the social group of primates and the amount of cortex in proportion to body weight. Because you got to deal with those alliances. You got to deal with those things. You know, who's grooming who? You know, who's in, who's out? There are a lot of studies that have shown that, to put it kind of bluntly, even if you're beta, you can still get laid. What I mean by that is that often beta animals in these hierarchies are more skillful socially. You know, it may be some comfort for those of you who, like me, were beta, certainly going through school. You know, beta types probably are smarter because they have to be. All right? So there's hope. All right? Because you got to figure stuff out. You know, how are you going to still get some if you're not alpha? All right. So there's hope. And then the third big jump, literally, love has driven the evolution of the brain. It's kind of remarkable. Is that tripling in size the last 2.5 million years? The majority of that build-out is social emotional capacities. Language, cooperative planning, empathy circuits, getting skillful at, alas, things like deception with other, you know, beings and so forth. I mean, it's really cool to imagine that it's been relationship skills that have really, really been arguably the primary driver of the evolution of the brain the last 80 or million years or so. Yeah. So all these three systems are important. They intertwine. One can use the others as means to its ends. That's a really important point. And while, for example, the attaching system, even though that's the last and kind of sits on top of the other two, uses the other two to fulfill its ends, and the other two can draw on attaching to fulfill their ends as well. All right? So the home base, in terms of these three systems, if you look at it, and to me there's tremendous evidence for this, when a person is not disturbed, troubled, upset, in pain, biochemically disturbed, what have you, what happens? The avoid system settles into a calmness. It's calm. There's no war. Okay? The approach system settles into contentment. And I'm using a single word here as an umbrella for a lot. There's a basic contentment, you know, which is essentially defined as there's no wish for this moment to be other than what it is. There's contentment combined with positive affect, positive emotion. It's a quality of there's a positive vedana, a positive feeling tone associated with the sense of just all rightness with the moment as it is. That's the approach system. And then the attached system, as you can see there, there's caring. We're naturally caring creatures, altruistic. We evolved to be altruistic. Whatever else is the case in terms of moral abstractions and principles, our actual nature is to be caring and responsive to the needs of others. All right? That's how we are when we're not threatened. And then as an emergent kind of synergy of all three, we're creative. People are generative. You know, they produce, they garden, they learn new recipes, they come to a workshop to learn something new. There's a creative process, right? This is the brain in its natural responsive mode. Or to look at a slide here, with wisdom and contentment at its heart, we have essentially a gratitude or gladness, peace and love as the, you know, nature of those three systems. I made this particular slide a couple months ago, and I've kind of been fiddling with the language here. Affiliate is the same as attach. I was reluctant to use attach because it has connotations in some circles of attachment is the root of suffering, blah, blah, blah. On the other hand, to me, the value of, you know, nodding to the whole attachment system in psychology, you know, made the benefit of attach over affiliate worth it. And then gratitude is great. I thought gladness was a broader word. You'll see me use it a little bit later on. It's all good. You know, we're in this fundamental state of mind. I think this is the nature of an enlightened brain. It's active. Those systems are still going. It's not, you know, cut off. Those neural tracts have not been severed, but they're functioning in a particular mode. The problem is, and I'll tell you what, I'll run through a fair amount and then I'll pause. The problem is, to survive, Mother Nature has left us with many, many systems that, in effect, drive us from that home base, right? At the crack of a twig, the cough of a leopard, a frown, an anger, or even something arising inside our own mind, you know, if we feel threatened or harmed, we're in reactive mode, unless we're practicing with it, okay? But let's talk here about the conventional response. If we can't attain important goals, we're disappointed, if we're frustrated, then we get reactivated in the approaching system. And then last, very well known to us, if we feel isolated, left out, you know, cast aside, insulted, abandoned, unattuned to, unloved, then we get reactively activated in the attaching system. That's the brain in its reactive mode of functioning, which is a kind of inner homelessness. For me, this is quite poignant. Not homeless in the Buddhist sense, which is considered to be a good thing, you know, going forth into homelessness, but rather an inner homelessness that to me is really quite painful. Okay. And you can see the triangle of that, which kind of summarizes that mode as well. At the extreme, just in passing, and I'm going to not dwell on this slide, but in part because there's so many therapists in the room, you can really categorize the DSM-4, which is the Manual of Mental Psychiatric Disorders, so-called, into these three systems quite well. Some are blends, but a lot of them fall really quite interestingly into these three systems because these three systems are fundamental to the nervous system. So, for example, just to look at the bottom one, just to go through it a little bit, you know, borderline personality disorders, people who cling and burn, right, in effect, because of a lot of early childhood wounding, which for me should call for a lot of compassion, that's an extreme version of a reactivity in the attaching system. Or just think about people we know, our clients, ourselves, who keep going back to the same stone breast for milk, right? Or keep going down the same tunnel, even if there's no cheese down it. Knowing there's no cheese down it, they keep going down the same tunnel. Okay. So, oh yeah, here we go. In other words, the systems persist. You can't be a Buddha. You can't be someone who's awash in inner peace and love and equanimity. You can't just be awash in equanimity by shutting down these systems. The question is, and this is a key distinction, which mode are they in? That's the choice. In other words, are they in a reactive mode? And you can see the attributes of this. Or are they in a responsive mode? It's typical to move back and forth even within a day between the two modes, or even to have, you know, some of one and some of another blend moments. I think that's all really true. I think it's also true that people tend to stabilize in one mode or another. The good news, with practice, hopefully we stabilize increasingly in the responsive mode. On the board here, I spent a fair amount of time with Spirit Rock teachers, and I think back on situations where things happened that would have driven most people into a reactive mode, and that's where I saw them really walk their talk. You know, they just weren't triggered in that reactive mode and sustained a responsive mode. And, you know, hopefully we're all moving more and more and more in that direction and beyond. All right? The other bad news, some people stabilize in reactive mode. I think that's hell on earth. You know, when you're stuck in reactive mode, just your, you know, fear and anger and heartache and frustration and disappointment and confusion and discontent. I mean, that's kind of home base, and, you know, in a sense. That's where people get stuck in some case. Obviously, many factors determine which mode gets expressed. Some are external, some are internal. I have a slide I believe I'll show you later that practice is really about in my language, deepening the keel in the water, or in the language of the slide, you know, in Buddha, increasing the range of experiences in which one can retain one's equanimity. All right? Okay. In other words, here's our choice. And for me, this has been so helpful, honestly, just to think about these triangles. You know, what am I in, right? Am I in greed, hatred, and heartache? Right? Broadly defined. Or am I in gladness, you know, peace, and love? Which mode are we in? So, how to come home? How to recover the natural, responsive mode of the brain? Right? That's the question, isn't it? So, the good news is that it's our home base. You know, that's what we default to. We just need to uncover it. That's our natural state. So how do we come home, really, to where we've been all along? It reminds me of the T.S. Eliot line, right? At the end of our journeying, we are back where we started, but we know the place for the first time. He said it better, but that's a paraphrase. Okay, so overall, as a method, what we do is we, in the Tibetan phrase, take the fruit as the path. In other words, we increasingly activate responsive mode state, which over time, because neurons that fire together wire together, becomes responsive mode trait. In other words, by increasingly activating gladness, love, and peace, broadly defined, you know, for approach, attach, and avoid, those three systems, we gradually embody those as traits. Quick sidebar, the reason I put them in that order is that because the avoid system is so primitive and powerful, it's in a lot of ways it's the last to go. It's the last to train. And it's really helpful to actually start with the attaching system and the approaching system and get kind of settled there and then move into the avoiding system. And that's the order that I'll go through this here. All right, so let's talk about some of the ways to get into the approaching system. But before I go further, any quick questions or comments? Yeah.
I have a question about the avoiding system. You were mentioning the avoidance of pulling back. But isn't there also the attack defense that is part of that system? Don't you also go towards things in a defensive mechanism?
Right. The question is, in effect, don't we sometimes, you know, have the best defense as a good offense? In other words, that we avoid what we don't like, right? We want to make that threat go away, okay? In part, we do that by, you know, resisting it, or we also do it by approaching other beneficial things. And for me, that's just an example of how we use the approaching system as a way in the service of the avoiding system. You know, so for example, people approach building up resources, let's say piling up money to protect themselves against threats. Or nations pile up armaments. They approach weapon systems and invest deeply in, you know, military-industrial complexes to develop resources to protect themselves against threats. Yeah.
So anger seems to be a outward-directed rather than a withdrawal.
Oh, I follow you. I think you're right. Anger is externally directed. But in the broadest sense, it's to make that bad thing go away. In other words, make that stick go away. The key point here is what's the functional purpose? You know, as they said of Al Capone when they caught him, follow the money, right? What's the point? That's how to really follow the mind. What's the function that's served? So that's the key point. Okay, maybe one more person right there.
Could you give a broader definition of spiritual materialism and the approach and the
approach? Where are, which slide are you on? Oh, yeah. Ah, yeah, okay, thank you. So, spiritual materialism is a term from Sokni, or not Sokni, Chogyam Trungpa, Chogyam Trungpa, Tibetan teacher, no longer alive. And he described the pitfall that numerous other people have described as well. His phrase for it is really pithy and memorable, that they try to pile up spiritual accomplishments. So they apply greed, if you will, and acquisition to spiritual life, much as they might, much as someone else might apply it on the blackjack table in Vegas. Right? That's what spiritual materialism is. That's some of the, I think of that as reactive mode. In effect, reactive mode corresponds to the first four lower layers of Maslow's need hierarchy, because they're all deficiency needs. There's a sense of lack or wound or disturbance, right? There's trouble in some way embedded in each of these in the reactive mode. And then there's a strategy that follows, that it serves a functional purpose that comes out of that sense of deficiency. Something's a problem. You know, there's trouble in River City. On the other hand, the responsive mode comes out of a sense of prior fullness, prior all-rightness in terms of the avoiding system, prior safety and strength, and prior connecting, prior love in terms of the attaching system. Maybe one more person? See, right here, I'm approaching this water in the service of avoiding my throat hurting. So, you know, that's a lot of what happens. Okay. Sure. So when I was trying to identify peak states, if you will, that we care about, I did list peak productivity. And I think there you have states of flow, or people who are just in a creative zone. They're in the zone. And I haven't spoken much more about it because sort of the aims here in a Buddhist setting, in a Buddhist workshop, is more about things like, you know, well-being and spiritual development and so forth. But absolutely, I think it's really great to reflect on the fact, as my friend Patrick said, people who are enlightened or pretty close to it are very generative. They're in that mode of generativity and creativity and productivity. They're very productive people. Right, great. I love this. So the questionnaire comment, really, a useful one is, but in a sense, if you imagine people who are very developed in being mode, lateral network activation, when they're productive, they're in doing mode, right? And how does that work? I suspect it's simply that there's a place for both modes, first. Second, I suspect also that people who are really far along, first they differentiate, then they integrate, you know, as I said earlier. And then I think also, in a funny kind of way, doing becomes being. I don't know if you ever read Zen and the Art of Archery. Really a sweet book. I remember reading a while ago, and the part that really stuck in my mind is the way that the guy who wrote the book, Eugen Herigel, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, German guy, goes to Japan, I think, right after World War I, or maybe before World War I, actually, trains with a traditional Japanese archer master. So Eugen comes in, okay, show me how to, you know, shoot a bow and arrow. And the archer said, here, hold this bow. No, just hold the bow. And that's all you do. And then, you know, a month or two later, okay, now you get to hold the string and the bow both together. Then for like a year or something, you would have him hold it, pull it back, bring it forward. Hold it, pull it back, bring it forward. You know, he would train him intricately in doing, if you will. But then, ultimately, the practice was to give over and just, you know, be fluid. So, for example, he describes the story of watching his teacher in the archery range, if you will, long passageway, maybe from here to the back of the room, something like that. And he, and in darkness, his teacher had set up a little wand about maybe an inch wide at the other end, like a ruler, you know, at the other end. And in darkness, his teacher, with his back to the ruler, picked up the bow, put the arrow in it, turn and in one fluid motion, you know, bow, arrow, pull, release, whoosh, split the wand. Just like that. That's where doing becomes being. And I think that is, you know, and I think that's where doing becomes being with people far along, and that's where doing becomes being for all of us at different moments of productivity. Okay. Let's keep going, all right? Let's keep doing some being. All right. So, the approach system. So I want to talk about some key methods here. Okay, good. And let me just see where I am. And I want to talk about essentially two key aspects of the approach system. There are a lot of things I could talk about. First, let's think about what promotes gladness and gratitude as it is. So here's an interesting list of good facts. It's a sad commentary on the world today that I had to come up with a list like this. But anyway, you can see how it's structured probably, right? We have on the top the approaching system, then we have the attaching system, then we have the avoiding system, and then we have some general ones at the very bottom that kind of cross all three systems. These are good facts. And it's interesting to take this list and to spend a few minutes every day just being aware of them and calling them to mind. Right? It doesn't mean we're avoiding the bad news. It doesn't mean that we're tuning out the harms and so forth in the world. But it means we're also recognizing the other side of the truth, the other part of the truth, the good facts that promote gladness and gratitude. The Buddha talked about gladdening the heart. Gratitude is a lovely state of mind. Just thinking about things that make us feel like we've been given something, you know, given the build-out instructions for the brain, given this moment, you know, people being kind to us, offering things to us, the science, spiritual teachings are all just given, right? Nobody pays the scientist directly to publish a paper, right? So you might ask yourself, where does your mind naturally rest? And where do you tend to get agitated? In other words, approach, avoid, attach. What's your tendency to have the most suffering? And then it would be abuse to focus on the good facts that have to do with that particular system. And then that takes us to this next step, which is to say the next slide, which is to defeating the negativity bias of the brain by actually internalizing the state of gladness and gratitude or other positive states like fulfillment in accomplishing an important goal or satisfaction at accomplishing something, finishing a piece of writing, let's say, and so forth, and helping them really, really sink in. The problem is the brain has a kind of negativity bias in which in evolution, sticks mattered more than carrots. In other words, if a person missed a carrot today, they should have a good chance at a carrot tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid a stick today, whap, no more carrots forever. All right? So there are dedicated systems in the brain that look for bad news, lock onto it, ignore the rest, blow it out of proportion, react to it, store the bad news and the reactions deep in memory systems and position them for fast retrieval at the least association to the bad event and the bad and the painful reaction to it. The result is this gradual incorporation into the residues or into implicit memory of the residues of painful experience, even if most of life is fairly positive or at least neutral. The brain is, as I've said, you may have heard me, like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones, unless it's a $1 million moment. So to defeat that negativity bias, which is a great way to pass on gene copies, but a terrible way to have quality of life, we need to take the fact and start with the fact that Mother Nature is tilted against quality of life and actively focus on good facts and actively savor them and actively intend that they sink into memory to level the playing field. That just brings us level. To really get on our own side and half a dozen times a day or more really focus on some kind of Good fact. So let's, oh, question, then we'll practice this a couple times.
How is this the same or different than CBT?
Cognitive behavioral therapy, right? So I think that it overlaps in a lot of ways. I don't think I invented taking in the good. What I've tried to do is neurologize it and tease apart its key elements. And I think that this method is involved in good therapies and other forms of personal growth or spiritual development. The difference here for me, that's or a point of emphasis, if you think, is while the C in CBT cognitive will look for good facts, to be sure, okay, and the B will talk about behaving in new ways based on those good facts, I'm not always so sure that people's learning curve is that steep. In other words, I'm not so sure that they're actually actively taking the 30 seconds at a time to really stimulate those neurons, to get them really firing together, so they wire together to the degree to which they can overcome that enormous pile of negative implicit memories. So I think this method, as well as this applied to MBSR, is really useful because it's a great way to help personal growth, therapeutic healing, spiritual development, stick to our ribs. Haven't you had the experience that you got something or you knew something? And it's what somebody said earlier. I know it, but then I find myself doing the same dumb thing yet again. And that's that second stage of growth, right? Well, it's because we didn't help it stick to the ribs. My view is, man, it's hard work, you know? It happened. I earned this realization. Take it in, take it in, take it in. So it's there, not out of greed and grasping, but out of being on one's own side and self-compassion. I got it. Let me be a one-trial learner. Right? Yeah, okay. One more?
On this seek and savor, seek soak savor, how much...
Did you just invent that? Seek soak savor?
Yeah.
I love it. The three S's. I had the three C's previously. That's the three. Seek, soak, savor. Oh, I'm going to use that. I'll try to remember to acknowledge you. Keep going.
How much in terms of, you said us doing the seek, soak, save. I just think that way. But
good.
Us in terms of doing that, you said makes the playing field level.
Yeah.
So how much in terms of this, developing these neural pathways to kind of encouraging them to come this way. How much of the sustaining it for a long period of time versus the returning to it does the strongest development? I assume there's a combination.
Great
of both.
Question. Okay, so basically it's a question about memory, particularly memory for emotion and sensation, because that's mostly what we're internalizing. We're internalizing positive experiences, not positive ideas. And again, I think that's a thing that's useful here in terms of CBT, to highlight the experiential, somatic, you know, embodied dimension, not to devalue cognition. Cognition is really useful. We're doing a lot of cognition here, or cognizing, but to really appreciate this in the body. Well, the question in a sense is, what's more valuable or more powerful in terms of building out neural substrates, repetition or intensity? And actually, I think like a lot of things, both are important. And duration. So the three things every school teacher knows that really promote learning are intensity, multimodality, so you feel it in the whole of your body and even maybe enact it out, and duration. Intensity, multimodality, and duration. And I suspect with a level of clarity that will be developed in the next 100 years, people will appreciate that for certain kinds of learning, intensity really matters. I think it's a little bit like weightlifting. You know, if you want to do certain kinds of things, you know, you want to lift 10 pounds 20 times, you want to do other kinds of muscle building, you lift 50 pounds 3 times or something like that, you know. But I think altogether in the real world, most of the time you'll do this method is in the flow of life. You won't do what we're going to do momentarily, which is deliberately call up a good fact and then seek, soak, and savor. In real life, stuff happens, right? Someone looks at you and smiles right there. It's an opportunity for a little moment of feeling good. Or you get a load of laundry done. Or you finally get the kids to bed. or you balance your checkbook, or you get to the bottom of your email in basket. You know, I can tell you about that one. Whatever. Or you recognize something good about yourself. That's a really important one. You recognize something good about yourself in your nature. No halos, but definitely something legitimately good about yourself. And then you feel it. Take 20, 30 seconds, hang out with it. It's a private act. No one needs to know you're doing it. And really, really soak it in. And so you do. Okay. So, and so what my point, though, is that when that happens, you know, sometimes it will be intense. Sometimes it's not that intense. On the 0 to 10 scale of intensity, it's a 1 or a 2. But you hang out with it. You stay with it. And implicitly, there's a real uber benefit in that by taking in the good consciously, one is implicitly being for oneself and taking a stance of caring and nurturance that may well have been in short supply when you were growing up. So in itself, it's a self-nurturing and self-healing act. Okay, one more person, then we'll do a practice. Yeah.
So is it like that repetition is like making the grooves deeper in the brain? And so is it also like creating new habits?
Yes. Yeah, what you do, for example, the question is it repetition, digging new grooves? Are you also making new habits? Yes. Any single time, most of the time, a person has a positive experience, those neurons are firing, they're wiring. It's a fairly small thing. With repetition of momentarily intense positive experiences, let's say half a dozen times a day, my clinical experience is that within a few weeks, if not sooner, people feel really quite different. It's a great practice for kids, too, just before bed, roughly ages 3 to 13, when they'll put up with psychobabble to extend their bedtime. They'll let you talk about this and the jewel going into the treasure chest of the heart, the soothing golden syrup going down into the body, you know, healing those old bruises in places, you know, et cetera, inside, right? So all those things really, really work. The thing I think to really appreciate here, for me, all the psychological methods I know, and I know a lot of them at this point, like therapists do, this is top five for me, maybe number one, including the fourth step. And I'm going to tell you the fourth step. I didn't have planned to it, so I'll tell you the fourth step. Fourth step is the optional step. And the fourth step of taking in the good. So, and when we do this practice, we'll do it with two cautions. So, the fourth step is to sense that the positive experience is prominent in awareness, and it's also associating with, kind of in the background, some place of pain or lack. So that one is internalizing this positive experience into old places of deficit, where one didn't get enough in childhood or marriage or what have you, or where one is wounded. So for example, myself, I was very young going through school. I felt like an outsider a lot, looking through glass wall at what was going on. I didn't have issues around autonomy, but I definitely did not feel included or wanted. So this is where a notion of the antidote experience is really helpful. And I'm only going to talk about this a tiny bit. On my website, I put up slides from workshops I've done for therapists on taking the good, where I talk about the antidote experience. It's the idea that certain experiences are kind of nonspecific and beneficial. They're great. Other experiences are quite specifically beneficial for particular areas of hurt or lack in ourselves. So for me, going through life, experiences of autonomy and self-directedness were great, but they didn't really fill the hole in my heart. They weren't the vitamin I needed for that shortage. On the other hand, when I kind of figured this out in my 20s, like, wow, I could really do this. I could repair myself from the inside out, which made me happy because I had a lot of self-directedness going for me. I looked for opportunities to feel included, little ones and large ones. And every time I did, many times I did, I would just kind of take a moment and feel the current moment, the current experience of being included, sinking down into old places inside and younger layers inside where little Ricky did not get enough of that inclusion. Any single time wasn't going to save me. I visualized the hole in my heart about the size of a construction site for a skyscraper, these huge holes. But every day I'd walk by and I'd throw a few bricks in, right? Day by day, remember Tibetan saying, take care of the minutes, the years take care of themselves. You know, brick by brick, day by day, weeks passed, feeling different, months, years, quite different. 35 years later, really, 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 really different. So that's the fourth step. To do the fourth step, we have to be able to do two things. One, divide attention. That's why little kids can't do the fourth step. They don't really have the executive functions built out in the prefrontal cortex to divide attention. If we can do open, spacious mindfulness, that's divided attention. You're intending and recollecting the state of, you know, spacious awareness while being simultaneously aware of what moves through it. Okay. If you can take notes while listening, that's divided attention. Talk with a friend while driving, that's divided attention. All right. Second, a person has to be able to hold that old place of lack or pain dim and in the background of the mind. Otherwise, it will hijack the positive experience. And it'll be like doing one more lap in hell, as I said earlier. Technically, when we bring to mind painful material, either by starting with the positive, as in the example I gave, and then sending it back to that old place that's negative or painful, or if we start with something painful and then deliberately say, after we've done the first phase long enough, right? Remember, it's important to do that first phase of mindful being with long enough, let it be long enough, then we shift over to activating the positive thing. Under either conditions, right, of the fourth step, we are holding two things in awareness. We've pulled up some negative material, and this is a really cool and useful thing about the way memory works. When something is pulled up into awareness, including an implicit memory, not even for an event that was traumatic or painful, but just a feeling, right, of anxiety or anger or being small or a loser or lame, whatever. When that comes up, it gets rebuilt. It doesn't just get retrieved in toto. It gets regenerated into the field of awareness, right? Then, here's the key part. I'm so excited about this. When it goes back down, it gets reconsolidated. And while it's being reconsolidated, it's vulnerable to intervention. You can intervene biochemically, like with rats, by injecting something into them right then and there, and it erases the memory of the trauma. Let me tell you, people in America today are studying how to do that. The guy who did a lot of the major research on this in his book that I read said he, as soon as the press got out about this, some guy called him up and said, can you help me forget my ex-wife? Right? Or you can fill in the blank for your own ex-husband, whatever. But no, it's more complex than that. But the point is that when it's going back down, it's vulnerable to intervention. That means that if you really, really stay with that strong sense of the positive, it will gradually infuse the negative and go all the way back down and take it with it over time, not eliminating the memory. You won't falsify the memory for what happened. I don't think that's good. But the emotional associations to that old lack or pain will gradually be healed. And no one knows, I think, what the upper limit of the possibilities are of this in terms of dealing with trauma. I think it's really important with trauma people to be very careful about this fourth step and not let them get re-hijacked, because if they're sucked into the black hole of the trauma, it's just one more lap in hell, and they're digging that pathway one little bit more deeply. I don't want to go much more into this, but I invite you to go onto my website. The fourth chapter of Buddha's Brain is also about taking in the good. Okay, a couple people. Yeah.
Maybe I'm going where you didn't want to go.
Probably, but that's all right.
So, I'm very interested in issues of trauma and kids.
Yeah.
Okay. So you just said before the full development, anyway, of the prefrontal cortex, and I get that, and what that's all about, and how that all the risk taking, etc., that comes along with that. But then the piece, there's so many youth in our country that are so traumatized in ways that you talked about earlier, by violence and just all that stuff, all that bad stuff. So I'm trying to think about how taking in the good without the fourth step may still work with young people who have been traumatized. Or is it more like wait until they get a little older and then try?
Wonderful question. I'm not a trauma specialist, so I have modesty about what I'm about to say here. So the question is, what to do with people in general, and certainly the most vulnerable and youngest people, who've had traumatic experiences or a lot of painful experiences, let's say. And can one just do the first three steps, and is that valuable itself? And I think the answer resoundingly from both research and direct observation and common sense is yes. I'm thinking of an appeal I got in the mail just the other day for the Fresh Air Fund, which takes inner city kids in New York and takes them to the country, or even to parks or farms. You know, and even just a little experience like that can be amazingly helpful for people. You know, as long as the person and as long as the brain is capable of experiencing something pleasant, having a pleasant feeling tone, and staying with it, right there, you can build positive resources into the brain. And the more the better, right? And also one can, without pulling up the old painful material per se, one can deliberately aim for antidote experiences. Like, for example, I've taken a lot of people rock climbing. And one of the more memorable times, I took kids who had been transferred into a special school in San Francisco, mostly for behavior problems, including really pretty intense things. Most of these kids were from terrible life circumstances, you know, tenements, totally, you know, one parent in drug rehab, one parent in jail, or the insane asylum, whatever, you know. And we took them rock climbing in Marin, and what was sweet was that they were actually afraid of being attacked by deer. Bambi, you know, because for them it was alien. And these guys go to sleep every night in places that would freak me out, you know, gunshots and whatnot nearby. But it was so interesting how much they appreciated, for example, having a sense of control. Like when you do rock climbing, if you do it well with ropes and stuff, you can really set up a controlled environment where the climber going up or even coming down can feel a tremendous sense of control. And it's really if you're patient with them. And I feel quite moved about it, actually, the opportunity for them to have that sense of control. We didn't name it. We didn't say, yeah, dude, this is a great antidote for your experiences of being pushed around in life. You know, we didn't have to. We just did those things. So we didn't even think about it. I wasn't thinking about the three steps. Most people don't think about doing, you know, but we do good stuff anyway. So I'm very hopeful about all that. Hey, so let's do it. All right, enough already. All right, so where am I here? Good facts. Let's start with good facts. I'm going to do this three times. And I feel moved and inspired. I just feel the go-get-em spirit in the room. No, thanks, so. So, remember, this is not therapy. The value, there is value in the fourth step, but, you know, remember, get back out of the deep end on your own. All right? There's my view, there's no benefit in just getting sucked into old pain per se. There is benefit in holding that old pain, that tablespoon of salt, in a much larger space, right? But just old pain per se, I don't see much value in that, particularly past the point of recognition and knowing what it is. All right. So bring to mind, for starters, a good fact in one of these three categories. And why don't we kind of start simple here? So just pick any kind of a good fact that's real for you right now. And then we're going to do the first three steps of taking in the good. All right? So bring to mind some kind of good fact and then let that move your needle. Let yourself experience something positive related to the good fact. Okay. As you're doing this, really try to stay with it and help this positive experience to fill your body. The last. It may be subtle. It may be kind of loud, either way is fine. And then as you can, let it fill your mind as much as possible, as intensely as possible. If it crumbles or fades, that's fine. Just go back to it. Take half a minute or so with the second step here of really savoring it. It's a kind of mindfulness practice. And all the while, third step, sense and intend that this experience is sinking into you. You might visualize it as a light or a golden syrup sinking down into you, maybe a jewel going into your own treasure chest in the heart. Or just simply, there could be a knowing, this is becoming a part of me. Okay, you did it. Come on back. Maybe you don't want to come back. Hey, let's try it again, just for fun. There's a lot of aptitude in here. So, and we'll just do the first three steps again. Pick another good fact. I nominate some good quality that you have that's factually the case. Of patience, or determination, or grit, goodwill, compassion, inquiry, whatever. Or anything else, and then, first step, actually do it on your own, the first three steps. Register a good fact, let it become a good experience, second, savor it, 20, 30 seconds in a row, while sensing and intending, third step, let it sink in. Okay. All right. Now, let's edge into the deeper end of the pool. Think about those three systems and, you know, kind of general pain or sorrow or lack, maybe related to being frustrated about attaining important goals. That would be the approaching system. Or maybe pain or lack or wounding related to feeling wanted, attuned to, cherished, loved, the attaching system. Or maybe pain or lack related to feeling attacked or pounded on, invaded, overwhelmed. That would be the avoiding system. So, of those three systems, pick one where there are issues that could be general or specific. Just try to find something, but something that you can hold in awareness without getting hijacked by it. And then, maybe take a look at this board here, because you want to help yourself not get sucked in to that place of pain. And for the system that has to do with the place of lack or pain, really clearly identify some true facts that you believe in that are antidotes or compensatory factors for that old place of pain. In other words, if a person felt frustrated and disappointed in terms of the approaching system, bring to mind things that are good facts where you've actually accomplished things. You've achieved things. You've gotten things done. You've made things happen. You've attained rewards, carrots, that you really care about. Or, if the wound is in the attaching system, bring to mind good facts of the people who are your friends, the people who have cared about you, do care about you, people, pets, spirits, what have you. It's real. Or, for example, in the avoiding system, if there's a sense of being attacked or assaulted, overwhelmed, bring to mind good facts that have to do with resources and strengths, allies, sense of safety. So get your antidote experience in your mind. Get the antidote-related facts and experiences clear in your head so that you can do this practice. Okay? And if at any time you feel excessively drawn into the black hole of the old pain, drop it and just go back to only the good facts and good experience. So let's begin. Bring to mind the positive fact, that's the antidote fact, and really wallow in the positive antidote experience. Gently bat away any distractors to it or resistance to it. This is your refuge, this positive experience. And as you do this, really engage the second and third steps as well, of savoring it, exploring it, letting it fill your body, letting it be multimodal, helping it last, helping it intensify, and intending that it sink in. It's prominent and in the foreground of awareness. And then, if you like, begin with the fourth step of sensing that this positive experience is sinking down into old places of lack or pain that are dimly sensed in the background of awareness. Perhaps with each inhalation, sensing that you are getting the food you need, the sustenance you need. Maybe sensing that a young part of you is finally getting today what she or he has always needed. Okay, come on back, move back out of that if you could. Come back to the positive experience, reground in it. Okay, anybody like to share about that or ask a question? I'll restate it, but if you could say it louder, it'd be nice.
Yeah. I'm wondering about chronology because I had a more recent, or actually current, difficult situation, and I was going back in time for the antidote to it. And then you said that it's more the opposite, the classic of, and it was, in fact, hard to time travel that prior things forward.
Yeah. Okay, so the question is, in comment, the The way I said it was I talked about an old place of pain, and that was an error on my part for exactly the reason you said. The truth is sometimes it's an old resource that really, or an old positive experience that we can call to mind, and it's new current pain, right? So both are true. But whether the positive experience is recent or based on recalling something from quite long ago, in either case, to do the fourth step, which is embedded in many successful therapies, is to have what's positive be prominent. And then what's painful, difficult, contracting, you know, problematic, and so forth, be dim and in the background. Because we want the positive to infuse the negative, not the other way around.
And it's harder to make it prominent if it's in the dim past.
To some extent, she was saying it's harder to make it prominent if it's an old thing. That's true, but I don't think that's always true. I think sometimes some of our most prominent experiences of being loved are with our grandparents when we were young, right? Or situations in camp, like coming to mind, like some of the experiences of feeling really seen and acknowledged go way back to when I was a camp counselor when I was 16. And out of the blue, the guy in charge said something to me that I'll never forget. You know, little moments like that, so whatever works. Different things, it's the jukebox, it's skillfulness, what works. You know, what resources can you activate that work for you and your nervous system? All right. One thing I should add, too, is that most of the time when we do this fourth step kind of practice, we do it on the fly in everyday life. We don't sit here and close our eyes and work our way through the steps. Something good happens. It's an opportunity. And when we know ourselves really well, we know what our holes are. You know what the hole is in your heart, right? I know what mine is. I got a couple, right? I kind of know what they are. I know how they feel, and I know what's around the edges. I know what it feels like to fall into them. We each know the hole in our heart. The trick is then to start actively looking for antidote experiences to gradually fill the hole in the heart. And I should say this, and then I'll respond there. Where am I here? It comes up at this point often, gee, am I being selfish, right, if I'm looking for positive experiences? I mean, for me, my friends kind of joked about it for a while in my 20s. Like, they'd say, yeah, Rick, I was glad you're in that meeting, or yeah, you know, that was fun with you. And I'd say, oh, what'd you like about it? And I did it mostly, not out of grasping and greed, but out of skillful means, that I knew that was food, that was mana, that was the vitamin C that I needed. That was vitamin L for love. That's what I needed. I needed vitamin L, or more exactly, you know, vitamin I for inclusion, really. Okay. Yeah. Oh, so I was going to say, here's a great quote from Bertrand Russell that, you know, the truth is that, and lots of research shows it, you know, some significant exceptions, generally speaking, the more we feel filled up ourselves, the more we fill the hole in our heart ourselves, the more we take in the good, both, you know, non-specific and targeted antidotes, the more we do that, the more our own cup runneth over, and the more we have to offer others. You know, happy people are good people because happiness is skillful means. Okay. There was someone right there? Yeah. And then we'll move on after this one.
Okay. Just to get clear, because you mentioned something about not falsifying the situation, and that would be a concern of mine, not to intentionally try to reshape something that really is what it is.
It really did happen. It really did bonk you. Yeah, I think that, okay, so the question is about working with memory. And there are different schools of thought in therapy, and people talk about rewriting personal history and doing narrative therapy and things like that. And I think it's one thing to look at the whole mosaic and to place that really yucky tile in larger perspective, right? And reframing things and acknowledging, wow, ways that one had not really recognized that one had coped, that one, you know, etc. Okay? But, for example, to somehow try to make oneself believe that one wasn't, fill in the blank, you know, mistreated in that way, what have you, I don't think A, that works, and B, that's good. That's what I mean by that. And with regard more generally, it's interesting. If you think about those good facts, that little list of good facts, there's no million-dollar moment here. This is all around us. This is everyday life, right? It's all around. And, you know, most of the time, we're not thinking about these good facts, right, which are opportunities for building in resources. We're often caught up in, negativity, because of the negativity bias, and then culture and politics manipulate us, etc. So, anyway, I just want to kind of, I'm doing a sampler here, in effect, of methods for each of these three systems. I want to name one thing fairly briefly, then we'll take a break, okay? Which is the critical importance in Buddhist practice of renunciation. How could we talk about equanimity? How could we also talk about wisdom with regard to the approaching system without reference to renunciation? All right. So I want to talk a little bit about this. Renunciation is the middle path between hedonism on the one side, where we just kind of greedily try to pile up positive experiences, and asceticism on the other side, which was the premier path to awakening in the Buddhist time. And his great teaching was, you know, that doesn't really work. Okay? At least not for him, and at least not for many, many people. This gets at the distinction I said earlier between tanha and chanda. In other words, between craving that leads to suffering, that has a drivenness in it and a sense of deficiency in it, like something's lacking. All right? That's tanha. Whereas, on the other hand, that sense of already being fulfilled and safe and belonging, already glad, loving, and peaceful, and on the basis of that, living out into the world from one's goodness and enjoyments and particular mode of contributing to the world and to the planet. That's wholesome desire. And there's a place for that. Okay? As you can see here in the third bullet, some recent research. It's really interesting. The way the brain works is that to kind of unpack the chain of dependent origination a little bit, to appreciate what the Buddha taught, but to be willing to do what he did, which is to innovate a little bit sometimes, and then judge these innovations on their merits. If you look at the processing stream in the brain and you watch your own experience, there's a stimulus. There's that initial feeling tone. Is it pleasant or unpleasant, right? Then, interestingly, there's a distinction that moves to enjoying it, liking it, in a word, which then moves to wanting, and then gets increasingly focused on pursuing. You see those distinctions? In other words, there are things in life that are pleasant that we don't particularly like. Like, for example, I walk through the Macy's, you know, I walk through the perfume section, and the aromas are pleasant to mammals like us, including male mammals. I don't particularly like them. It's my nature. I don't particularly like them. I think if I walked past some jasmine, it's both pleasant and I instantly like it. Perfume per se, it's just fairly neutral. It doesn't activate liking. See the distinction right there? Then a person can like something, but not tip over into wanting it. That right there, roughly, is the distinction between the pleasant feeling tone, if you will, and kind of liking it, but not getting caught up in craving. There's a story that many people have heard. I'll retell it briefly. Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn's an honorific, like rabbi or something like that. Not quite, but anyway. Sumedho's an American. He's probably the senior American or Western monk, really, in the Theravadan tradition. He was practicing with Ajahn Chah, great teacher, kind of the major teacher of many of the teachers here, Spirit Rock, including Jack Kornfield, and some really, really beautiful young Thai women came to visit the monastery and were hanging out with the monks who are, of course, abstaining from sex. They're men in their 20s and early 20s. The sap is definitely rising, and yet they're not engaging on any of that. And after the young women left and everything was very appropriate and proper, the monks and so forth, Ajahn Chah essentially said to Ajahn Sumedho, "So, Sumedho, what'd you think?" Yeah, right? Messing with him. And Ajahn Sumedho replied, "I liked, but I didn't want." And that's the tipping point. That's the distinction. And then there's wanting. It's interesting to appreciate that in studies of addictions. You can imagine a 2x2 matrix, like, don't like, want, don't want, right? So then you get four quadrants, if you will, states. So obviously a person can not like and not want. That's simple. A person can also like and want. There I think we can have both wholesome and unwholesome activity. It's interesting, though, to break it out. What happens if a person likes but doesn't want? Some people describe that as heaven. That we're moving through life, we're enjoying life, but we're not tipped into want into its negative and excessively elaborated way. Isn't that a nice, I like this 2x2 matrix thing. And then on the other side, wanting without liking, that's hell. And it's interesting that different neural circuits do wanting and do liking, right? And growing research is decoupling these and teasing these apart. So for example, people who are addicted, I think of hell in May is working the slots in Vegas. I just watch those people sometimes. They don't look like they're happy, right? They're just doing it. They don't. Or people who wash their hands the 50th time that day. They don't like washing their hands, but they want to do it. See? Wanting without liking. So the point is we can kind of decouple these. And renunciation is a lot about not being tipped in this chain that moves from the feeling tone to enjoying. Enjoying is yellow flag because the brain wants to want what it enjoys. Because that's a great way to train iguanas and monkeys and cavemen and women to survive and pass on their genes. So be careful. You know, I think of a lot of people talk to play around with this idea of the new Western Tantra. You know, the life of the senses as a path of awakening. Maybe. I think there's a reason why the Buddha stressed renunciation, and he was so cautionary so many times about not getting sucked into sensual pleasure. Okay? Like, yellow flag. Want, orange, if not red. Okay? All right. Good. All right. So here's some great language about renunciation. Essentially, the Buddha talked about the distinctions between the gratification, the danger, and the escape. And in a minute, we'll go into a break. 1 minute from now, please don't go yet. I'll leave the slide up during the break. But you can see he's saying flat out, he's saying, look, when I didn't get deeply the danger in gratification, and I didn't embody in my life fully the escape from that danger, I was not yet fully awakened. So he's establishing that in his view, see for yourself, decide for yourself always what you think is true. He's saying, it's the real deal, folks. You know, getting caught up in the gratification without seeing the danger is not awakening. All right? And what is that escape? It's the removal of desire and lust, the abandonment of desire and lust for sensual pleasures. You know, it's very hard to do that, isn't it, in a household or life? And I think there are degrees of it, and you know, I think the thing to do is to see where you are and then consider the next rung in the ladder. And not fault yourself for not being at the top of the ladder yet. At least that's what I do. So, how about we take a quick break and we renounce the pain and suffering? Or I don't know if that really works. Okay, I'll see you back. And this is a good time. Oh, I have an email list back there. If you want to get on my email list for the Wise Brain Bulletin and the Just One Thing newsletter, I'll never give your name to anybody else. And you can always unsubscribe. It's back there, too. Okay, see you in 15 minutes. Oh, hello.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Do you remember me? I've been in your workshop so many times.
I'm remembering you.
I get your email.
Yeah.
I have responded to it.
Oh, thank you.
So I wanted to get this book here.
Oh, thank you. Tell me your name again.
Emma.
How do you spell that?
E-M-M-A.
Oh, that's easy. Okay.
I'm so glad I got it.
Oh, thank you.
I got to so many bookstores and they don't have them.
I know, I bug my publisher from time to time and try to retain my equanimity, but I don't always, about them not managing that. But they do a good job. That's why people go to Amazon, or Spirit Rock.
Yeah, Orinda is a very bookstore. It's a small bookstore.
Or they'll order it for you.
Yeah, so they told me when to order and I wanted to get it from you. So.
You are the 10th person, probably the 50th, who said that. Oh, I should stop this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.